Okay. My name is Burnett F. Hansen, but better known as Barney Hansen. And my wife's name is Borghild Hansen, or Borghild Hendrickson before she would become my wife, Borghild Hansen now.
You live in Eagle. Your address is Eagle?
My.
Born, Mr. Hansen?
In 1894, September the 28th.
And
Napa County.
Yeah, this is just for the record. What are the name of your parents and what business were they in?
My father's name was P-E-D-E-R, Peter Nicholas Hansen, and he was born in Flora, Norway in 1863, February either the 12th or the 22nd. His birthday came on the day of one of the president's days, you know, and I forget which one it was. I was quite young when he passed on. And my mother was born in Auckland, New Zealand, and my grandparents, their name were Camel, or C-A-M-M-E-L-L, Camel, and they were from England, and my grandfather was the oldest son of the Camel, of Camel and Laird, at that time one of the largest shipbuilding firms in the world, still is, I guess. But he didn't want to continue. He was the oldest son, and he wanted to get out on his own, I guess, instead of shipbuilding, and so he went to the colonies, which New Zealand was at that time.
Have you folks any children?
Sir?
Have you any children?
We have one, yes. One son, Jim. James Henry Hansen. 25 years old.
What business are you in now, mining?
Well, the last business I was in, I was mining, yes. For myself, I have worked at odd jobs since.
Well, I guess your hobbies are mining, too.
Oh, yes.
What made you decide to come to Alaska? When did you come?
Well, the first time I was going to come to Alaska was in the teens or early teens too. It was when the Kennecott Copper Company was putting in and had changed their location of their seaward base from the first place to Cordova. And I come from there. If the other fellow had come with me, we'd have come, but he was busy and I was never out of work either, and I didn't get to come at that time. And then in 1929, I had decided to come. I was at that time, I was working for the Union Oil Company and come. Do you want me to tell from the time I was a kid?
Oh, well, I don't think so.
No, that's all right.
I want to hear about. We want to hear about your Alaskan experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I came in 1929, come down the river on the first boat, and I landed in Eagle June the 4th in 1929, and in the evening. And the next day, I started out for the 70 mile with a brother of mine and Bert Bryant for Alder Creek. And the first stop was at Summit Cabin. And we started out that night. The next evening we started out for Alder Creek, that was it. And we went as far as the Summit Cabin and rested a little while. And the pack that I had was pretty heavy. And we looked through it there and see if there's something we couldn't get rid of. But no, we had to have everything. And I was even packing a couple of pair of boots for fellas that was on up to 70 mile. And those big old high ones too then. They're not light and tough like they got now. But then we went on and got to Crooked Creek just as they were getting up in the morning. And we had breakfast there and stayed that day and had our supper with them there. There was Art Frolic and Coomer and Gus Douglas, that's here in town now. He was working for Art Frolic and Coomer. They were partners there on Crooked Creek. They had a hydraulic outfit there then. And let's see, there was someone else too. Can't remember just who it is now, offhand, quick enough. Then when I went to put on the pack that night, I had it sitting against the building there, and I went to get down to get in it, you know. And Art Frolic says, "Oh, you don't need to do that." He says, "I'll hold it up for you." When he went to hold it up for him, he couldn't do it. He says, "My Art man," he said, "you can't pack that." Well, I got this far without going to try it the rest of the way. And we made it to the falls, stayed there with Axel Johnson for a little while, went on to Barney Creek. And we stayed there for 3 or 4 days. It was raining, man, it rained all the time we were there. And there was a fellow there by the name of Bob Cameron, and he wanted me to go over and help him pack some old flume boxes from a bench that is on what they call a little Pleasant Creek. And there's the old cabin, you can still see where it is up on that bench there yet. And a fellow by the name of Jess Samish, and a fellow by the name of Frog, they ground sluiced some there. They built a ditch around the hill there, and they ground sluiced a little bit there. But then Frog broke his leg, and Jess packed him down to the river, and they got Nimrod Robinson to boat him into Eagle to get his leg fixed there at the post, at the Army post, the doctor there, you see. But I helped do that. And in order to go up the Yukon, up the 70 mile further, there's a big mud bluff there, and the 70 mile keeps cutting into it, and it's about 300-400 yards across it, and it's pretty high. And with that pack I had, I looked at it, and the 70 mile, oh, it was roaring, it was awful high. And my golly, if I had an axe, I believe, or a hatchet or something, I believe I'd cut foot holes in there and get around there instead of climbing up over that thing. Well, this Bob Cameron loaned me a little axe, and I did. I made it around. But, you know, I'd never do it again. Never. And then that evening, we got to, early afternoon, we got to old Yost's place, old Charlie Yost's. And that was an experience, you know. Now, I've been out all my life in the woods, most of it. And because outside in Washington, I've even been a professional hunter for coyotes and stuff like that, for sheep men out there. And so I know what it's like being out, and I've looked after the cattle for the cattle. Okay. And then it's only 4 miles over the hill, and it's just up like that, across the flat and down into Alder Creek. Well, you got to go across Deep Creek too. And Ed Brathard, I knew him outside, and he and his wife had come in the winter and to go up on Alder Creek too. So they were there waiting for us when we come. And you know, on the first boat down the river every spring, why, there's always some fresh eggs and fruit and oranges and bananas and stuff like that. Well, then there was the mail for all the people out along the river, and you got to take that out too. So we had, that was the reason I had a good big pack. And we worked there that summer and continued on there. And I guess that's it.
Well, where did Mrs. Hunt come in now on this?
You let her tell it now.
You tell about that, Mrs. Hunt.
Well, perhaps I should tell you, first of all, that I wasn't born in California or any of the other states, but I was born in a little insignificant town in Norway. And so I'm thoroughly Norwegian. But you see, Barney's only half, but he's half English and half Norwegian. But
he looks like a Scotchman to me.
He sounds like a Missourian. But my mother and father, of course, lived in this little town, but my father was a deep-sea captain, and when I was 9 months old, he was drowned. He with all his crew and the ship, everything went down off the coast of England in a storm. But then mother remained a widow for about 3 years, when my uncle, or her husband's older brother, my father's older brother, who had immigrated to America previously, made a visit back to Norway, and during that time he persuaded Mother to venture to the New World too. So in the spring of 1900, while Mother and I came to America, and then all the way to North Dakota, where my uncle was, and they were married there, and I spent my childhood on the prairies of North Dakota. But then, of course, North Dakota is somewhat like Alaska, as far as climate is concerned, only a lot worse, I think. I enjoy Alaska more than I did North Dakota. And we really did pioneer, I think, out there more than I ever have here in Alaska. We even lived in a sod house there for a while before Father was able to build a house out of lumber. We were so far from town, and of course the means were hard to get. I remember one time, well, I don't remember it now, but I've been told by Mother that the first Christmas that we spent there in the sod house, we've only spent one Christmas, Father brought home from town a load of lumber and a half a pound of peppermint candy and a scissor of a catalog. And I enjoyed looking at the catalog. I guess it was pretty hard for Mother at times because she hadn't been used to any of this, but being a child, I seemed to enjoy it. Then went to school in Chicago, and while in Chicago one year, I happened to meet a girl from Alaska that had been with the BIA, and she was so wrapped up in Alaska and the people up here that she couldn't talk about anything else, it seemed. And my sister was there also. My sister and Lydia, as I was her name, and I had light housekeeping rooms together, and we were really fed Alaska 3 meals a day. But it was real interesting. I had never considered Alaska as my field before, but I had thought of going to China as a missionary. But she spoke of Alaska so much to me that finally I consented, sending in my application to the BIA. And with her help, I did, and of course I really didn't expect to get anything. And the answer was that they had no vacancies at the time. And I went on working. After school was out, I went on working. I was working in the drug department of Marshall Field store at the time. And then about the middle of September, I decided I was going home for a while to North Dakota. And after being there a few days, a telegram came from Seattle saying there was a vacancy at Eagle for a school teacher, and the school was grades 1 through 8. And if I wanted it, to wire right back, collect, and prepare to come right away. And it, at first, it, of course, I hadn't even told my folks about having applied for this work in Alaska, so it was a big surprise to them. And it was a surprise to me, too, because I wasn't expecting it. But then the following morning, I did a little praying about it that night. I believed in doing that when it's something that's of importance. And the next morning, I felt so sure that it was the thing to do. And when I met Father in the kitchen the next morning and greeted him, and he says, "You're going to Alaska, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." He says, "I could tell by the gleam in your eye." So in a week's time, I was off. I was in Seattle and ready to board the Alameda. I don't know if any of you remember the Alameda.
I've been on her a lot of times.
Have you?
Yes.
Well, she was a pretty nice old boat. Of course, I wasn't used to boats at the time, and I thought it was wonderful. And we did have a wonderful trip coming up. That Inside Passage, which some of you, or perhaps most of you, know is really 1,000 miles of scenic grandeur. and I enjoyed it so much. Then after, of course, we came to White Horse and over the Narrow Gauge Railway, and then to Dawson by riverboat. But when I arrived in Dawson, they told me there was no boat for Dawson, or for Eagle leaving Dawson, that the last boat of the season had already gone downriver for Nenana and lower points on the river. Well, it was hard to believe. It was only 104 miles or something like that from Dawson to Eagle. And I thought, oh, surely there'd be some means of getting down there. But evidently there wasn't. I found out, though, that there was a small boat carrying some perishables that had not been in Dawson at the time when the big steamer went down, the Yukon. And this small boat was carrying a load of perishables down to 40 Mile, the old 40 Mile station. I suppose some of you know of it. And so I asked if they would take me along as far as 40 Mile. And I thought, oh, if I get to 40 Mile, that's halfways anyhow, and I'll surely get to Eagle from there. But I got to 40 Mile, and there was no way of getting any farther. So I stayed there 9 days. And but as luck would have it, Mr. and Mrs. Schultz, some of you may remember them, had the roadhouse there. And Mrs. Schultz was quite crippled up with arthritis. And of course, I was able to help her, and that helped to pass the time. Then on the first day of October, the reason I was so late was because they had already hired a teacher at Eagle, and she became ill and had to leave, and that's how come I got in on this. But then on the 1st of October, this mail carrier that carried the mail from the time that the Yukon steamer quit carrying mail until the next spring when the river opened again and another steamer would be on the river. So this man, Percy D. Wolf, which some of you may have heard of, he carried the mail by launch in the fall until the river froze, and then dog team, and sometimes horses during the winter when the river was frozen properly. But I came down with him on the 1st of October and landed in Eagle that evening, and I thought to myself, my, what a beautiful setting for a little town. I was going to say, perhaps Horace would like to tell us something about mail carrying. Yeah. Horace Biederman and his father carried the mail between Circle and Eagle for many, many years.
Horace, and I don't believe I haven't met you since I was in, many years ago, I was in Eagle. I remember meeting you.
You did, yeah.
Can you give me your name and where you were born?
Horace Biederman is my name. Born and raised on the Yukon River, you might say, on the banks of the Yukon.
Your present address is at Eagle?
Eagle, Alaska.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were born in Eagle?
At Circle.
At Circle.
Yeah.
And are you married, Horace?
Well, I'm widowed, yeah.
Do you have any children?
Two children.
Mm-hmm. We ask these because we know someday your children will want to hear these stories, you know.
Sure.
And what business you're in now? You're in mercantile business yet?
I'm NC agent there at Eagle there. Yeah. Operate their store there.
And can you describe your childhood and where you went to school?
Oh, what little schooling I had was right there at Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about 15 years old while the old man taking me out of school and put me on the mail run between Eagle and Circle. How this come about, he'd froze his feet the year before on the 5th of January right out of Circle there. And he had the back of his feet amputated, so the following year he took me out of school to finish out the contract. That was 1928. 25 and 6, the winter of 25 and 26.
Mm-hmm. You were born in 1910.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell about that mail run down there and tell us what the life was like on it?
Well, at that time I thought it was pretty rugged, being only 15 years old. It was a 6-day run normally, 6 days a circle, and then we used to have a day off there, and then it was 6 days back to Eagle, and that continued along for 6 months, starting the 1st of November through April 30th.
Your mail came to you from where, Dawson?
From Dawson.
How was the river to run? Was it pretty rough? Did you?
Well, it closes fairly rough, but normally it's not too bad.
Name us your overnight stops. You leave Eagle. Describe the 6-day run.
Yeah, well, leaving Eagle, we had that was the shortest run there from there to Sheep Creek, known as the Totondic on the map. We always called it Sheep Creek. That's where Miller's wood camp was. And then from there, the Nation was about 25 miles. And then from there to Charlie Creek or the Candick River was another 30 miles. Then from there, the Wood Chopper, another 28 miles. There was a good roadhouse always at Wood Chopper. Then at 26 mile, we had to camp out there in a little log shack there. And from there, the circle was 26 miles. So we'd average 22 to 30 mile day run.
Was the roadhouse, the Slavin had a roadhouse at Coal Creek at that time too?
Yeah, but we never stopped there.
Mm-hmm.
At that time he lived on up Coal Creek. He wasn't at the mouth of Coal Creek.
Mm-hmm.
That roadhouse there was built in later years.
Mm-hmm.
How many dogs? Well, dogs, we didn't drive big teams, about 7 and 8 dogs, mostly.
But were they Malamutes?
Well, I don't know. They were mostly mongrels, but they were good big work dogs, yeah.
Did you ever drive any part wolf?
No, I never have.
I was going to say, this other mail carrier that carried the mail from Dawson to Eagle, he had part wolf dogs, some of them. Percy
DeVoe.
I think he bred some, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know one time I went outside and I come back in over the trail from Whitehorse to Dawson and in the winter and sat on top of a sled and just ride up there, and when it's around 40, 45, 50 below, it gets pretty cold. They do furnish you a wolf robe though to wrap up in, but even then sitting there, you know, it gets pretty cold. And when we got to Dawson, why, of course, we come on down to Eagle with Percy DeWolf. And he had got a couple, another horse or two, and had him on a big basket sled, something like a dog sled, but only big enough for a horse. Well, you drove one yourself, you see. And I'll tell you a funny thing. Percy was in the front one, and I was... Ed Brassett at the time was driving the horse right behind us, and I had been running along in between them to keep warm. And we come to a place, we was on a portage. You know, you're not on the ice all the time on the river. You come to a big, long, sweeping bend while you go across. Well, we was on a portage, and it's not always too even either, and we come to a place where there's kind of a little pitch. And Percy was sitting on the handlebar of his sled, you know, on the handlebar over there, and basket started here, and he was sitting sideways there, you know. And he's looking back, and he didn't notice that that horse was pretty smart, too. When he come to a little pitch, why, he'd automatically start a little fast, see? Well, that's what he done. And the snow was awful deep in there, too. And old Percy fell off over backwards. He lit right back on the flat of his back, and he was a hollering, whoa, whoa, whoa. The horse stopped after he got up on top, though. And you know what the comical part was? I had to help him out of that. He was a floundering around and put me in mind of a big stink bug. Trying to get up. He had so much clothes on. I'll tell you, when he come out of the morning, though, out of his bedroom in the front room of his house there in Cassiar, why, man, he had a pile of socks that high. And they didn't all go on just straight, you know. Every other sock went with the leg part down over around the foot again, too. And he had those there stove boots made in proportion, too. Now, he never got cold. But I'll tell you one thing. It didn't matter how cold it was, Percy de Wolf went. 70 below or not, he went, didn't he?
That's right.
Yeah, he was known as the Iron Man of the North. That's what they used to call him.
Can you tell us the stopovers from between Dawson and Eagle? So that pitches right into Horace's.
Down there 12 miles, the first stop, isn't it?
Well, that was just a noon stop.
Yeah.
His home was the first
stop.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You know it better than I do.
Well, name them all.
That was, they call that halfway, I believe, Percy's old camp there. He lived there a year, his family lived there, and he fished there in the summer, known as halfway. Then from there, 40 mile was the halfway stop between Eagle and Circle. And then the next stop was at John Fanning's, about a little over 20 miles above Eagle. That was a 4-day run from Dawson to Eagle.
Tell me, you said you stopped at the Charlie Creek below Nation. They've got another name on that river.
That's the Candic,
Candic,
mouth of the Candic River, yeah. Right
now the old name was Charlie Creek, wasn't it? And then that's different from the Charlie River, was on
the
other side.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're 10 miles apart.
I know it's Mark.
No,
that's only 3 miles below town, so it wasn't a stop.
Where
did
Moose
Hide.
Oh,
have?
Moose Hide, no.
How big was your load?
So while the mail limit was 400 pounds, and you'd leave Circle usually with a limit at that time. Prior to 1922, I believe it was, all the mail for our end was routed around by way of the White Pass and Dawson. It came down the river, this Percy the Wolf hauled at the Eagle, and then it was distributed there for the 40-mile chicken country and all the way to Circle. But sometime after the railroad got in here, the mail was routed around by way of Fairbanks and Circle. We hauled it upriver. That took you in the 40-mile area, too.
That was quite a while after I came in, because we had mail. I remember receiving our mail downriver by way of Dawson for quite some years.
Yeah.
And we had mail 3 times a month, the 9th, 19th, and 29th.
That's right.
And always on time.
Was that mail all first class or some second?
All second class and even fourth class parcel closed in.
Of course, in the winter time, there were times when they were not able to carry all the fourth class mail like the parcel post, and then we would just get the first class mail sometimes. But we always got it and always on time.
Well, you didn't tell us about your life in the Eagle, Mrs.
Well. As I was going to say before, I should have said this before, I remember very well the 4th of June, I think it was, when the two Hanson brothers came to town, and they didn't look as though they'd be able to carry a load like he said he was carrying, because they were both pretty heavy, but stout too. But anyhow, they didn't stick around long enough for to get acquainted with them at the time.
You were teaching school,
I was teaching school, yes. Of course, school was out for the summer at the time, and but I remember seeing them and meeting them one evening. But anyhow, I went to the village. You know, I had not been accustomed to Indians, and I wasn't so sure just how to meet them, and a little bit leery. But the second day, I started walking up to the village. It's 3 miles from the village. And the second day, I started up by myself. And I was told by the people of Eagle, or one or two people, to be sure and carry a heavy club to chase away the loose dogs when I got to the village. Well, I did pick up a club after I got started the village. And then after I got part ways up there, about halfway up, why I heard voices. And I stopped and listened, and it was in a different tone. I couldn't understand it at all. Pretty soon I saw two men coming towards me, and I didn't know whether they could speak English or not. But anyhow, one of them was smiling, just grinning from ear to ear. And the other one was very solemn. And I thought, so that one was the type that I expected, the one that was solemn. But when I met them, they both spoke good English, both carrying guns, of course. And I was walking through the brush to the village. And then they sort of looked at one another and said something in their native tongue. Of course, at first they said, "You are the teacher, the new teacher, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And the younger one said, "We've been looking for you. We're glad to have you come." So that helped some. And then they mentioned, they looked at the sticks and they looked at one another. And finally the youngest one said, "Why do you carry the big stick?" Well, I said, "I was told that I better have a stick because there might be loose dogs in the village." "Oh," he says, "well, the loose dogs are not harmful." He says, "My people wouldn't let the dogs hurt you. You don't need to be afraid." So, of course, I felt still better. And I continued on for a ways, and finally I thought, well, I'm going to get out of this brush. So I got down on the river beach and walked the rest of the way. Of course, they saw me quite a ways from the village then, and the children and different ones came to meet me. And the chief met me and took me to the school building and opened the door for me. He had the key. And they were so very nice. And I thought, my, why did I even wonder about them? And I found that those people were, they were just wonderful people. That's, of course, a long time ago now. That was in 1925. But they were hard workers and kind and good to their families, took care of their families. And I found that they were just a wonderful class of people. And I, of course, had many experiences. Sometimes the teaching was really the smallest part of the work because there's so much nursing to do from time to time. And accidents such as slipped toes and mashed fingers and so on. One fellow came to me with a thumb which would look more like a piece of hamburger than anything else. And at that time, we couldn't get into Eagle by airplane like we can now. And, of course, the BIA was not willing to charter just any time for anyone in particular. In fact, we didn't have the airplane service at that time. But we managed pretty well once in a while. Someone passed away, but it was usually the far advanced TB cases. And of course, I delivered a lot of babies, or helped deliver a lot of babies. I couldn't tell you how many. But I enjoyed it. It was hard work, lots of work, but I enjoyed it. One time we were driven out of our village by a flood, and we had to move to the ridge above, a little higher ground. And the whole village was entirely flooded, but not a cabin was washed away. So we were thankful for that, and I really admired my people, how they went back to that, to those cabins that were, had several inches of silt and mud in them. And everything that was outside of the cabin, of course, was washed away, and a lot of the things that were inside. But they were grateful to have the cabins and whatever they had left, and really went to work and cleaned it up. Then I
stayed with the DIA for 13 years, basically, and then married Glenn Hemp. That wasn't until 1938, though.
And how did you meet him?
Well, I met him the first day he came into Eagle. And I happened to be downtown. Of course, we always like to see the boats come in.
Did you live in the, did you live in the Indian village?
Oh, yeah.
You lived up to the Indian. You didn't live in the town of Eagle when we were teaching that.
No, there were quarters for the teacher up there with this school, and I lived there. The teachers always lived together. Of course, we burned wood and had the water packed from either the stream in the back of the village, and in the wintertime we used ice for water. You know, you carry the ice up. And we contracted for fuel from the natives. They would cut wood. We burnt wood all together. And gas lamps. We had no electricity. But we kept...
About 1938 when they started their regular flight. When they took over the mail contract. It was carried briefly from 1930 to 34 by Pan Am. Their service was very satisfactory, and then we carried it by dogs again from 34 to 38, and then from then on, some airplanes every day.
Marty, when did you get into mining? Was your brother up there with you?
He was the first year, but the mosquitoes bothered him something awful, that is, and they didn't bother me because they could sting, but it didn't do any good for the mosquitoes. But it raised great big welts on him, you know. He just couldn't stand it. So he says, I'm going back out of here this fall. He says, and I'm never coming back. And he's never been back either. But I stayed. But, about that Pan Am, having a mail contract for that while. Well, they just brought it to Eagle, and then they would have somebody else haul it back down the river, you know, like the rural mail route, like it used to be. You see, between Circle and Eagle, why, they carried the mail and they'd deliver it to each one that was along, too. And Max Goose, an old fellow there in Eagle, he had the mail contract to haul it down to as far as Nation. And, you know, he was quite bow-legged, and he was getting pretty well up in years, and he smoked a pipe constantly. And this is one little anecdote I saw happen there in Eagle. And somebody, he wanted to go, he forgot something. He went over to the store, a newer place. And it was Pete Somerville then, I think. And he got somebody to hold his dogs for him. And he had four or five young dogs for his scooping feet. And he'd come back there, you know, and he still had that pipe in his mouth. And the dogs, of course, they were just easy to start out, like most of them are in the morning. And when that fella let him loose, no, Max, he forgot himself, you know, and he just kind of, all right, he said, all right, you know, that pipe in his mouth. The next thing you know, he was flat right on his stomach, and he'd come up with that pipe. Boy, he was coughing, he's putting it running through the back of his neck, I guess. Well, the dogs, they just kept on going, and they caught him down the mouth of Mason, so... I'll never forget that. Then another time, Dick Bauer and I right there, we was down at Nation, and we was coming home to Eagle for, what was it, Christmas, wasn't it, Dick? Yeah, Christmas, I'm pretty sure. No, it was Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving it must have been. But anyway, Dick had a nice string of dogs, but we was down at Nation at the landing, and see, I was working for Dick at that time up on July Creek, mining up there. And we had quite a lot of stuff to freight up from the landing, which is 12 miles. And we had the one horse to do it with. There was a lot of baled hay and oats and all the stuff for the next summer's grub, you know, for four men and the cook. And got to 1,000 feet of 500 feet of 8-inch pipe.
1,000 feet of 8-inch pipe.
Yeah, and we got some 9-inch too, so it is nested. But I remember when we was coming, when we was on our way from Nation to Eagle, why, his dogs had got in a fight while we were gone. One of them had got loose, and his leader, we finally had to do away with him. And so then we didn't have a leader, and we picked out a big husky young dog, you know, to train as a leader. Well, we started out and stayed overnight down at Nation, and then we started out the next morning. It was starting to snow. Well, the day before when we got there, no, we stayed over there too. And Max Druce was there when we got our mail, and then he left the afternoon before to go back up to Sheep Creek, or the day before. So the next day we started out, and it was snowing quite pretty hard too. Well, above Nation, as you go up along the beach there, you go through the big slough. And then we crossed the river, and up a little ways on the other side is another slough that you go through to cut off the more long way, see? And when we went across the river there, why, pretty wide too, above the island there, you know. And the ice was just as smooth as that table. And I could look up the river there for, half a mile or so, and I saw one or two great big cakes sticking in it, and that was all. And I'd been running ahead of the dogs from Nation on up to there, and then when we got across the river, Dick says, "I change with you now." So I said, "Okay." So I went back and was standing on the back of the runner, see? That young leader we had, he didn't know enough to go or anything else, which way to go or anything, you know? So we had to trot ahead of him all the time. But we just went a little ways, and I thought I could feel that sled kind of going like that, you know, and I took and drug one foot along sideways like that to see if I could see the ice and see if I could see through it or anything, you know. But the snow just fell back in it, you know, it got quite a bit by then. And I said, "Oh, I guess I just imagined it stuff." But we kept on a-going, and we went on up and up the Montauk Cutoff and clear through the 14-mile Montauk Cutoff there. And got to Sheep Creek that night. Well, Max Drew's cabin was just a little ways down the river in the brush there, just a little ways from where we were staying at Heine Miller's. And he came up after supper, and he says to Dick, he says, "How'd you like that there trail I made around through the below there, Montauk Cutoff, through the woods down there?" Picture. Trail through the woods, and he said, "We didn't come through the woods," he said, "we come up the river." And they got into quite an argument, and it was about the corner to come calling one another liars. So I says, "Max," I says, "that's a fact." I said, "We came right on up the river." But before that, when they started arguing, he said, you had to come. You couldn't come by the river." He said, "That was all open water yesterday." "Yeah, all open water." Well, you know, after we found out it all open water, and that there sled had been going like that, you know, I knew it wasn't imagination either. But boy, I'm sure glad we didn't go through the ice there, just where the trail goes up the bank, the lower end of that Montauk Cutoff. Geez, fast there. Well, I'm sure lucky. And the comic, here's another thing too. That same trip, we did. Now Max, he left Sheep Creek that morning for Eagle, way ahead of us. We didn't leave for, we had an early lunch and left. Of course, didn't know about 27, 8 miles. 25 miles, rather, with the trail.
You called it 22.
I guess it did, with the cutoff, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when we crossed the river, you portage from just after you crossed the mouth of Sheep Creek, clear to the mouth of the 70 mile, or on the shore on the north side of the river, right across from there. And there's an island right in the middle of the river there, right in front of the 70 mile. Well, the trail goes across the lower end of that island, across the ice there, And, well, it doesn't cross the island. It crosses out on the ice here and then heads up that way to get off just above the 70 mile there. And when we come there, why, here was an open place for a quarter of a mile right down the river there, just to the lower end of that island. And old Max has trailed us right across it, you know. And it was about as far as the length of this table wide that she fell in, you know, and eased out that warm water going through the island, you know. And now that just goes to show that, and that was whipping right along in there too pretty fast. If Pully had ever dropped to a place like that, what a time he'd have of trying to get out. There's been a lot of fellas on that Yukon, all
said it. Ronnie, let me ask
you a
question. I heard you mention Susan and dropping you on.
Yes. He's kind of deaf.
I heard you mention Nimrod. I suppose all you old timers from over there need to go to Newman, that's Nimrod.
Yes.
What I wanted to ask you was, could you tell us briefly the story of Nimrod making a seat for his dog?
Yeah.
Not his dog.
For a dog?
No, I never heard that.
No.
I never heard that, but I thought it was easy for himself. He made out a caribou and then a piece for himself. I'll tell you.
The teeth that he made for himself, now the first set he made two sets. The first set wasn't perfect, he didn't think. And you know, I, like a big fool, was at his cabin up on Plume Creek. And all of his old diaries and everything were all there. And a lot of old, there used to be a post office there at Plume Creek. And a lot of that records were there. And I should have kept that stuff. And that first set of teeth that he made was there. And it was cast of aluminum, you see, with the teeth in it. But I left them there because I thought that old Nimrod was coming back up there, you see, but he never did. And before I got over there, somebody else had been through there. And there was nothing.
What were the teeth that he used for that?
Oh, it was sheep teeth and bear teeth mostly. And what he used to get the impression, to take his impression with, was the balsam gum. He was all over those hills up there just hunting that special balsam gum. You know, time meant nothing to Nimrod. When he wanted a certain shaped stick, well, he'd hunt through the woods till he found it. And there was an English outfit there, just to show you how particular the old fellow was, that was prospecting the 70 mile. And when they were there at Plume Creek, of course they weren't very particular, some of those fellas. They didn't even know how to much more than cut a tree down and like a beaver. So after they were gone, old Nimrod went all around there and cut those off decent. Yeah, the way they should be cut. Cut the rest of the stuff off. He didn't want anybody to know that, or think that, saw those, that he'd leave anything, that he would do anything like that.
It was said of Nimrod that he could do anything, make anything but a living.
he never knew
how to charge for anything, any of his services.
Dick was down at Nation. He had a big phonograph. Yeah, big Victor. And one of the little cog wheels inside of it broke. Well, Dick, he took it up to Eagle that time, that same trip. And he asked Nimrod if he could make one. Oh, yes. Yes, sure. But he says, Dick, he says, it'll cost too much. He says, the price would be prohibitive. He says, be cheaper to send me get another one. Dick says, well, I haven't got time to wait. He says, we're going back down the river pretty soon. He says, you go ahead and make it. So when it come time, why, he come with a beautiful job. Nice little cog wheel, you know, nice little gear. And we took it on down, but the comical part of it was this price that was prohibitive. How much was it, Dick?
$2.
For making that. And we put it in the phonograph, and it's still in there as near as I know. It works a lot better than the original. Pieces to you that he fired it out of.
Tell him about the little engine he made, buddy.
Well, I didn't get to see that engine he made, but I did I saw the lathe, the little jeweler's lathe that he made, and I guess that's in the museum in Juneau now, as near as I know. Didn't Jack Hillard get that and take it down there?
I believe he did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But he cast that himself. Yeah, he cast it himself. And, he was an artist with metallurgy. Oh, he was genius. Yeah. He made knives and he made beautiful knives, too.
Puzzle rings.
He was a good watchmaker. Good jeweler. That's what he was for trade.
Barney's a little guest, that's why he...
Barney, I wanted to tell you the story of the dog.
Yeah, go ahead.
Come up with Mike.
Yeah.
I'm not in this program, but I'd like to tell this story about this.
There was an old-timer here by the name of Henry Appel. I guess you all knew Henry.
Very well. I got the last picture ever of taking of him, I think.
Well, anyway, Henry Appel, I was over there just a few days before they took him to hospital. He had a few trinkets there in a little box that he gave to me. And one of these was a set of teeth that Nimrod made for his dog. It seems that when Nimrod died, Henry took the dog. That's the way I think Henry told me. Well, anyway, he gave me these teeth. Now, I've got them, and I can show them to you. He says that Nimrod made them. So they won't fit a human being, but the way that they look to me, did I show them to you?
No, I know. You told me about them, but you didn't show them.
But nevertheless, I have the...
When did you start mining by yourself? Where were you mining?
I mined in partnerships and one thing and another there on the 70 Mile, and I worked for Dick Bauer on July Creek. And 4th of July Creek, yes, that's right. And then I came over here and went to work for the FE Company.
We want to know mostly about your own mining.
Oh, yeah. Well, in 46, I started work... 47, I started working for myself. Well, I was in partner then with my brother-in-law, her brother. He would have been out to North Dakota during the war, and Jack Boswell and I were supposed to go to Salt Lake City and work for the FB after this was finished out here. See, when they stopped the war effort, started to stop this operation here. And we went out on the same airplane together, but before we went to work down there, while we were to have a couple of weeks with our families. His family was in eastern Oregon, and Mom and my wife and son were in North Dakota. And so I went to North Dakota, and when I got there, her father had a big place and couldn't get around very well with arthritis and stuff in his knees. And a lot of work to do, and nobody much to do it. And so I thought, well, I'd be better off if I'd just stay right there and help the old fella out. So I did. And the next summer, her youngest brother came home and took over the place. And but we stayed until that fall, until the crops was up, and then we hit out back for home. And when I got here at Fairbanks, I'd just gone up, stayed with Al Stout and his wife down there on Barnett, and 5th and Barnett, for a few days. And the second day after I'd got here, I come up to see Frank Pollock to charter a plane to go home to Eagle. But on the way back to Al Stout was with me. The noon whistle blew, and at that same time, there were automobile horns blew. It was right in front of Wechter's old store there on 2nd Avenue. And it was Bert Ogburn. And he left his car sitting right in the middle of the street. and they come running over on the sidewalk, and they wanted to know when I got back, and I said, yesterday, last night, rather. He says, why don't you write to us until you come? And I said, well, I figured on beating the letter anyway. And so he wanted me to come down and see him that afternoon, and I did, and he wanted me to come into the power plant because he couldn't get anybody they could trust. Then there's too many drunkards around, I guess, in there. And so I went in the powerhouse and worked there that winter. And the next summer, along in the spring, early summer, Jack Boswell come back from out there in Salt Lake City. That was the summer of 44. And he said, you and I got a new assignment. And that was for building that mechanical point driver. Well, we're the ones that designed that. And then the fall of 44, I went home to Eagle, up the river on Art Peterson's last boat. And then the winter of 46 and 7, I freighted our stuff into Alder Creek, and we started mining there the spring of 47. And we worked there for 2 years, and Pete, his wife, didn't like Alaska, so he left, and that left me there by myself. So my wife and I and our little kid, we went out there and worked on Alder Creek that summer ourselves, and my gosh, we had our trials that time too. We had high water. And I didn't know it, but the track rollers was pretty badly shot. And I had to get those and no place to get them from right then. And so they, even some of the flanges were gone off them, of the rollers. And so I had to take, I had some flat strap steel, thank you. And I took and hammered out round rings out of that steel, and then I welded them on and made new rollers, built them up, and used them for quite a long time. Then that, while I was doing that, I just got through, and my cat was sitting out on the tailings there, fairly close. Well, right close to camp, but the river came up, the creek rather, got so high that it was eating into the tailings there. And I was all by myself, and putting those rollers on in the rain and all day long, and getting the tracks back on. Of course, she come out and help me. And Jim, he wasn't old enough, big enough to do much then, but he'd do what he could. And I finally got it so I could go that night and get it out of there. Well, I had a lot of fuel to haul out of the road. And then our pipeline going into the boxes was right in the road of where this here flood was coming. And by the time I got the fuel out of the road, and there was one channel that I was trying to dam off, and I just pretty near make it, and by the time I'd back up and get another load of stuff, it was gone. Well, I finally got it with a lot of brush with it and got it to hang in quite a little, and I got pulling up here, and then I come back and I brought a big load, and I said, Kitty, if you ever push good this trip. And I got enough with those two loads to just stop it enough, so that I backed up and got another couple right quick, and I got it headed off. And I got a lot of willows and stuff into it, and I got that stopped. But while I was doing that down below here, where I had my dam to take the water out of the creek, through the pipe or on the sluice plate in the boxes, why, that was a-going. The pipeline was all big pipe, you know, it was all floating and rolling around, come apart. You know, hauling those out of there with a little go-devil, when you go to pick up one of those pipes, there's plumb half or three quarters full of water. Boy, they was heavy. And you just had to keep pulling and pulling and pulling and holding Well, the water was running out of them. Well, you'd get one end up on there, and then you'd have to hold that up and let the water out of that end. Well, we finally got it all, but as we got up toward the intake, why, it went a-sailing and all I could see. It went down the creek. It got into it and took it. We never found it for 2 or 3 years afterwards. Yeah, fishing, we found it. Went in under a kind of a bank where it was right. We went down the 70 mile every place else hunting for it. But it was just a little ways it went.
That trip, the horse that you used to make down the circle, did you see much game along the rivers in those days?
Well, mostly moose in the wintertime, along through January and December, January, February, we see quite a few moose along the river. Very seldom caribou, and they never hit you.
Did the big runs used to come over 70 miles?
Oh, man, yes. You'd wonder where they all come from. They'd be for about 6 weeks every fall there. They'd come through from Charlie River and down the down around the mouth of Charlie River. They crossed down that way. Some come from the north bank of the Yukon and into the 70 mile. And those high, big, bald hills there just look like as if they're moving. And for days and days and days. Well, I got in that same diary I was telling you about that old Nimrod had there. I stood there and read in his one diary there for a little while when I was in his cabin. And he was telling about, he sat in front of his cabin and what caribou went across that bench that's on the west side of Plume Creek just before it enters the 70 mile.